You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Oliver.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I cannot complain. Let me introduce you. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. You're Oliver Berkman. You write a column for The Guardian. The column is called, I think it's safe to say ironically, This Column Will Change Your Life. Not that it won't change your life. I don't mean to imply that for one second, but can you explain what the sense in which the title may be a bit ironic?
Yeah, very much. I feel like I spend a lot of time trying to explain that to people. But yes, it's definitely meant to ironically.
Yeah, but you know,
how do you define change, right? I mean, I guess some microscopic level.
If you are reading the column, you're doing something you would not have been doing if you hadn't read the column. So it has changed your life.
Right? In a minimalist sense, I guess it's
totally
true by definition every time. Yeah.
I would emphasize that if I were you. You're also the author of The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking, which we had a conversation about. People can delve into our archives. We will link to it.
Yeah.
And a book called Help, How to Become Slightly Happier and Get a Bit More Done. However ambitious all of these things may sound, I would say they pale by comparison with what we're going to talk about. You've written a big think piece in The Guardian. It's a long read, such a long read, in fact, that people can absorb it by listening to the podcast. The Guardian has a long read podcast, right? It's called, what's it called? Guardian Audio Long Read or something.
It's called The Audio Long Read, yeah.
Anyway, they got an actual human being to read it, not you, judging by the accent, but an actual human being. It's not just a machine. And so people can listen to this long read if they would rather do that than read it, but I recommend it. It's called How the News Took Over Reality, and it is a diagnosis of what ails us to some extent in this strange political era. It says that maybe what ails us isn't exactly what most people think, and for that reason, maybe the cure isn't the most commonly prescribed cure. I'll leave it at that. Do you want to give us your version of your thesis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a good way to set it up. I think the idea that I was trying to connect to initially was just this sense that I had got, since the 2016 US election, since Brexit and all of this stuff, that something was going on in addition to all the other things that we know are going on, in terms of the media environment. So, I wanted to pinpoint something that is not the same thing as we are all addicted to our smartphones, which we are, or the sort of hyper-partisan nature of politics in general, but just this sense that you get, but it's kind of hard to describe, I guess, but just that a lot of people have somehow changed the center of gravity in their lives such that the news is kind of where they primarily, first and foremost, live. And, you know, their sort of concrete lives of their families and neighborhoods and everything else is somehow kind of secondary. And that this kind of marinating in the news is something new and sort of distinct from just the fact that the news is so crazy. Mm-hmm. And it seems to go along with the other part of what I was trying to write. It seems to go along with this idea that you have a kind of a moral duty to stay informed about everything, and that you are somehow delinquent if you aren't consuming a lot of this stuff and feeling agonizing on behalf of all the people who are having a bad time. And I wanted to sort of question that. And I think the conclusion I try to reach in the piece is that actually there might be quite a strong moral imperative to not do that. That sort of disengaging from the news and even sort of choosing not to care about everything that you could conceivably and like justifiably care about might be better. Not only for sort of personal health, which I think is fairly well understood now, but actually for the health of democracy,
right?
That it's not something, democracy isn't something that works best when it is the only thing we're doing.
Right. So you're arguing that maybe by disengaging to some extent, we can actually make democracy work better, which is a kind of a challenging thesis. I mean, as you know, I run this thing called the Mindful Resistance Newsletter, and there the premise is that if you, you know, we're not counseling disengagement, although the newsletter is supposed to help people who want less immediate emotional involvement with the news by providing a kind of a summary of it that's less the news. It's not so likely to drive them nuts, but still, I guess the unspoken premise is that there is a form of engagement that's possible even amid all of this craziness that is constructive. But I have to admit, it's a challenge. And after reading your piece, I found it. I was forced to take even more seriously the idea that, and maybe it differs according to person. Maybe some people would be doing the world a favor by disengaging, and others wouldn't. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, and I shouldn't pretend for a moment that I've like completely disengaged from the news or anything. It's more, I think this idea about the moral imperative is really sort of an important part of it. This idea that you're sort of doing something bad if you decide to disconnect in certain ways. I feel like the story, one of the stories that sort of got quite got at this, which I mentioned in the piece, was this profile that the New York Times ran about a year after the 2016 election about this guy called Eric Hageman in Ohio, who had sort of completely radically disconnected from all the news, and he pumped white noise into his ears when he went to his local coffee shop so that he didn't hear anybody talking about Trump. And, you know, it was an obviously very extreme case, but there was a whole lot of coverage in response to that that basically said he was, you know, the most selfish person alive, that it was just because he was in a privileged position as a wealthy white male that he could disattend to all this stuff, and that, you know, if you're at the sharp end of what's happening with immigration or what's happening with police violence or anything else like that, you don't get the option to disconnect. And so, you know, it's just a monumentally selfish thing. But, you know, at the same time, he was spending his time, assuming the reporting was all accurate, you know, he was spending his time restoring some wetlands that he was going to give to the public once he'd finished restoring them. And it just sort of made you wonder, well, like, there has to be some reason. It can't just be the argument that, like, he ought to be sitting at home feeling bad about these things. You want that to be able to cash out into some kind of way of making things better, and it's not clear that it does, I think, all the time, especially in an attention economy that is, you know, designed to capture your attention with everything all the time as much as it possibly can. It doesn't seem to follow that the noblest path is always going to be to pay as much attention to it as you can. You might be able to do something better
So speaking of the attention economy, let's kind of back up and start with your diagnosis before we talk more about the prescription, because it there is a kind of novelty to it, I think. I mean, you know, my wife is a good example of what you're talking about, in the sense that she used to not pay that much attention to political developments. I did, because I had been in journalism. But we had, I would say, quite different degrees of conversancy in kind of everyday, you know, New York Times homepage or front page kind of political coverage. Now, I mean, she's, you know, rushing in to give me like news alerts and stuff. You know, it's like the tables have turned. And I think if you ask her what's happened, she would say Trump. But right. You're saying that's one thing that's happened, but it's not the only thing that's happened, right?
Right. I mean, you know, and Brexit stands in for Trump when you come at this from the UK side of things. No, because I mean, one of the things I was trying to get at is it's not new that the news should be kind of insane and lurid and full of kind of extraordinary developments that nobody can believe that is happening. That's something that, you know, various different times through history, there's been some version of. But what's totally new is this idea that the news is there as kind of part of your life, in the background of your mind, you know, the backdrop to your day all day long. There's some amazing stuff about the news bulletins during World War II, for example, and what tiny proportion of the day it would have been possible to follow news developments then, or even much later, you know, up through Vietnam and other times when, you know, really big stuff, consequential stuff is happening, but you just can't, it wasn't possible to just marinate in it. I think that's the thing. And then also you get this phenomenon in social media where you feel like, I think largely falsely, you feel like you're actually like a player in it, because it feels like retweeting, commenting, all the rest of it is somehow kind of acting on the story. It's not just, you're not just a spectator either. And that whole effect of this, I think is something, it is something over and above or in addition to just, you know, we're online all the time, we're addicted to our devices. It is this idea that like these enormous dramas are like where your life really happens. I don't know. It's really hard. It's a bit sort of abstract, but I feel it very deeply anyway.
Yeah, no, there's an erosion. I mean, you know, as you note, this has in some ways been a gradual process. I mean, CNN is what made news kind of, you know, round the clock video version of news possible. That was not nothing. But as you just said, the interactivity of it is another dimension where you can, you know, anyone can be a commentator before an audience of at least some size. And you also talk about this social theorist, this Korean-German social theorist who talks about a kind of, what is it, a breakdown of the barrier between kind of personal and political expression or something? How does he put it?
Yeah, this is Byung-Chul Han. I don't know if I'm pronouncing
that's close enough.
He wrote this book called In the Swarm. The basic idea is that well, I think lots of the hippie pioneers of the internet, right, they assumed that what would happen is the kind of public square, the thing that is typified in history by sort of the London coffee shops of the 18th century, the coffee houses, you know, this kind of public square that was restricted to just a few people would become, there'd be just a massive explosion in it. We would all become able to discuss things in public and reach, you know, better and more enlightened and more consensual decisions. But he says that, he makes the point that kind of relies on a kind of distance. So when you're relating to somebody in the public square, you're sort of bracketing, putting to one side, you know, your most disrespectful emotions, and you're sort of not asking too many questions about what's going on, like deep in there. Mm-hmm. Or their hang-ups, what they might be talking about in their therapy sessions. You're just sort of talking about the stuff that you're trying to decide. And that the internet collapses this, you know, that actually what it does is it doesn't expand the public sphere. It eliminates the distinction between the private and the public sphere so that everything is an instant emotional reaction to what happens. Everybody's darkest shadows, you know, in the psychoanalytic sense seem to be implicated in every argument they have about everything. So you're never able to sort of put that aside and just, you know, work out a solution to a specific political.
Right. If I might quote no less an authority than you, you write, social media blurs the distinction between making considered public comments on the news and impulsively emitting snatches of one's half-formed private impressions of it, which is very true. I mean, it's hard to arrange your Twitter feed such that you're only getting one of those. They do tend to be kind of intermingled, and you write, and it rewards and amplifies the most extreme expressions of emotion. And that's true too. I mean, it seems like there's a couple of things going on there. I mean, one is just that in a polarized age, you know, the people who get rewarded with the most retweets are the people who are the most, who emote the most, or say the stuff that most arouses emotion, right? Have you noticed this? Is this a frustration for you? Because you don't come off very tribally on Twitter. And that's like a disadvantage if you're actually trying to build up a big following, right?
Yeah. Although, are you talking about me personally? Not
you personally.
I'm extraordinarily complimented. Although I think I might be starting to belong to the tribe of people who object to the tribalism of my own side, which kind of might be a tribe.
I'm very interested in that. This is the tribe I'm interested in, is the tribalist tribe.
And you wrote that very good piece in Wired, I think, about Sam Harris and tribalism, which sort of touched on these kind of.
I thank you, and Sam doesn't, but go ahead.
I think the basic point is right. I mean, whenever I do catch myself just sort of being intemperate and losing it, especially if it involves, you know, pointing other people at someone else, some third party, and suggesting that they're being ridiculous, you know, I try not to do it. I subscribe to the Mindful Resistance newsletter, and I try to follow those, that sort of insert that pause before doing that. But whenever I fail, that's when I get the most, usually, I think, anyway, when I get the most retweets and favorites and feel like, you know, I get that sort of dopamine rush then. So yes, it's kind of, you are constantly having, if you're going to use that service at all, you're constantly having to sort of oppose your own impulses and the whole business model of the service to sort of do something on it that might be useful. Although I'm not even sure if that's useful anymore. I think probably I wonder if I can actually be on Twitter in any way that is.
I think there's a way to be on it without doing harm. And I even think there's a way to be on it and do some good. But I think it takes work, and you don't get a lot of positive reinforcement for it. And it's maybe unclear how much good you're doing, but, my sense of you is kind of like my sense of me. And by what I mean by that is, like, a couple of years ago, like in the beginning of the Trump Brexit era, kind of like late 2016 or so, I think, we both started off doing what was natural, which is ridiculing, the ridiculous, which in our view, and certainly includes Trump, and then slowly I have just done less and less of that. I still do it occasionally but it has seemed to me, I mean, not only less and less productive, but actively counterproductive, for various reasons. I mean, one of them is that in the case of Trump, you know, his supporters, a lot of his supporters, are driven to support him in part by the idea that people like you and me look down on them and think they're stupid and bigoted. And so the more you send those kinds of signals, the more you're strengthening his base. Now, the point you're making in this piece is not a tactical one about Trumpism. It's more about just having a corrosive effect on the conversation generically, and it being very hard to not have that effect without just disengaging, right?
Right. Yes. And then it sort of relates to this idea of, which we can talk about if you want, about, and it's not my idea and I should give proper credit, but to that doing democracy, that democracy is something you can overdo. You can be engaged too much in politics for its own good as well as for your own, psychological health. Yeah. And all the incentives of the attention economy are to do that, are to spend.
Well, I mean, the American Republic was not designed to be a direct democracy. That wasn't the idea. The idea was you elect these people, they go to D.C.
Right.
And in those days, it was assumed they would be largely insulated from you. I mean, it was impossible to get anything approaching real-time feedback from your constituents.
Right, right. Even to the extent that it is a popular democracy, or in the context of that, these are the ideas of Robert Talese, the political scientist at Vanderbilt University, who I quote fairly extensively in the piece. You know, there's this idea, his idea, among others, that you need a huge shared social and civic life that goes outside politics in order to sort of create the platform on which you can then, when you need to, have political arguments. What happens? Pardon me. I thought I'd turn my phone completely off, but apparently not. what happens when you when everything is politics, because you spend all your time on social media and you come to relate to everybody you relate to outside your immediate circle solely as a political player, is it becomes impossible to see, you know, the rest of anybody's personhood. And this just leads to all the sort of partisan tribal, it gets harder and harder to see people who disagree with you politically as human in any way. And that strikes me as a really powerful thought, that, you know, democracy works when you're also relating to your political opponents, you know, at the book club or the bowling league or in the office, and seeing the other parts of them, and that this is something that social media doesn't allow. I think the sort of strange and uncomfortable conclusion that it leads to is that a lot of what we think of as doing good is problematic, as well as, you know, on some level, I assume most of us feel when we're just sort of screaming mockery at the other side that is already kind of a bad thing to do. But this kind of suggests that, you know, spending all your time with like-minded people organizing protests and letter writing and doing things that feel like good, positive activism, that there's a limit beyond which that becomes a kind of turns your life into a lens where you can't see the other side as human. Okay. Does that make sense?
Well, elaborate a little on the downside. So what is it that starts happening? I mean, suppose you are organizing letter writing campaigns to people in Congress so that they'll quit supporting the Saudi military intervention in Yemen and doing stuff like that. And you keep track of the news in order to do things like that. You're saying, and you refrain from screaming at people, and maybe you even try to engage civilly people who disagree with you. But you're saying even if you maintain that kind of discipline, there's such a thing as going too far for yourself and maybe even for democracy.
Right. And I think, you know, I think it's not that those things are bad things to do, and it's not that you should not, you know, go on protest and write those letters. It's just that this has a natural effect. Again, I'm really, this is very much in Robert Talese's work, that you are more and more sort of sorting yourself into a social life that is defined exclusively by political affiliation. So you're going to end up spending more and more and more of your social life in a way that is defined by politics, with people who agree with you. Then you've got, you know, all the group polarization effects are going to kick in, where you know, these kind of effects, the situation where the people in your neighborhood, the people say you're going to like the same, you can predict somebody's political opinions from the movies you like, you know, this kind of gradual alignment of everything in your life outside your home with political opinions. Mm-hmm. So the sort of one of the ways to push against this, apart from not spending all your life on social media, getting more and more embedded in these specific bubbles, I think is to spend time in your life doing things that are not politics at all, right? That are with people who might have any political opinion. Where it's just like, I mean, that's the point I was trying to sort of convey at that part of the piece. That, go on, sorry.
Talese is the one in your piece who makes a point of doing things like going to bluegrass concerts, where he just does not know what the political affiliations of the people around him at the concert are.
Right, he's drawing a distinction, exactly. He's drawing a distinction between what we need to do to get over America's partisanship crisis is go out and find people from the other side of the aisle and have calm, rational conversations about politics, which is something people often talk about, right? Bridging the divide. And actually recommending instead, we just need to do things that are just not politics. Go places where politics and somebody's role as a political actor is just not relevant. Try to knit the fabric of this society that is something more than politics, so that we can bring sanity back to when we do have to have political disagreements about things.
Right. You know, it's interesting, though. It's a comment on America that there aren't that many kinds of musical concerts you can go to without being able to predict pretty confidently, right? I mean, like if it was country music instead of bluegrass, as it happens, bluegrass has a little bit of a kind of a lefty alternative following as well as a conservative one. But with so many kinds of music, you can predict with 95% confidence who they voted for, who any one person at the concert.
Yeah, and there's that, and then there's a huge geographical problem, right? I mean, I was thinking about how far I enact this in my own life, and I do not spend all my social life such that whatever social life the toddler permits, I don't spend it as completely fixated on politics as I think some people around here in Brooklyn do, but the fact that I go to
I thought that was a Brooklyn accent. I wasn't sure.
the fact that I go to a community choir that I absolutely love to bits and don't talk about politics there doesn't change the fact that, you know, I can predict the party affiliation of almost everyone in the room. That's just because it's Brooklyn, New York. I mean, so a lot of this is very hard to surmount just through sheer sort of geographical sorting, I think.
Yeah, there was a book I've got it on my bookshelf somewhere. What was it called? It was about this sorting thing. I think it's called The Big Sort by Bill Bishop. It came out some years ago, and it noted how, just in terms of physical, you know, residential patterns alone, there's been more and more of a correlation between where you live and what you believe. And of course, one thing you get into in the piece is, you do it kind of in passing since it's been so discussed, but the fact that the online world very naturally segregates people by ideology. I think you also get into Tim Wu's book, The Attention Merchants, yeah. I guess. You mentioned the attention economy earlier, and one point you're making, and I guess Tim is making, is that because there is so much information out there, because there's so many information merchants out there, mm-hmm. There is more and more competition for people's attention, because you can monetize attention via advertising and in other ways. And what that leads to, I gather you think, is more and more an appeal to the emotions as just the surest way to grab people's attention, or am I reading too much into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it, right? I mean, I think it's pretty well understood now that you know, that it's not that Twitter or Facebook want to make you angry, it's that making you angry is the best way to get you to keep using Twitter and Facebook. I think I think what's really interesting about all this to me is the way that you, if you want to participate as a publication or a organization in that realm, like, you just have to play by those rules, it seems, even if you disagree with them. So I mean, the problem I always think, you know, I'm sure you get 8,000 emails every day from charities, because I sometimes give a modest amount of money to a small number of charities, and then all the other ones get hold of the mailing lists. And, you know, you never are going to see the ACLU or whatever, the Sierra Club. You're never going to get any of these people saying that the thing they're raising money for today is like the third or fourth most important crisis facing.
Much less an email saying, hey, don't worry, there's really not much to worry about in the world.
Certainly not that. But not even saying, you know, like, I don't know, the crisis in Flint, Michigan may be the like seventh biggest crisis facing the United States right now. So please make sure to put it seventh in your charitable donations. You might as well say it doesn't matter at all if you're not going to say about everything that it's the most important thing. But it's not really their fault, right? I mean, it's just a race to the top.
Yeah, I mean, because they all, like all of us, think they're doing good, and in most of these cases I probably wouldn't argue with them, but anyway, we do by nature think we're doing good, and so, you know, things we do to draw attention to our cause and mobilize people are justified, I mean, unless they involve, you know, high crimes and
so then you have the situation where you've got, you know, bad actors and trolls competing for my attention, but some of the best people in the world competing for my attention, sure, and having to play by those same rules. And at that point, I feel like the idea that there is some sort of moral, some sort of duty to pay attention to it all seems a bit ridiculous and begins to seem counterproductive, right? Because I'm probably going to do better as a sort of engaged citizen by picking one or two issues and kind of trying not to care about the immense suffering associated with all the other ones.
Yeah. And, you know, journalists have to play by these rules. You know, one of the wisest things in retrospect that was ever said to me was said by Mike Kinsley, who was the founder of Slate and had been my boss at the New Republic before that. And this was in the very early days of Slate. Mm-hmm. He said to me, you realize what we now can get. And I think this is an underappreciated threshold, first of all. He said, we can now get data on which individual articles people are reading. Now, mm-hmm, we take that for granted now. But before the digital age, you know, you would send out a magazine and you knew how many copies the magazine sold. Mm-hmm. But as far as feedback on individual articles, all you got were letters to the editor and kind of social feedback. So like your editor, if they were at a cocktail party and somebody said, I really liked Bob's piece, well, your star had risen, and that was the feedback they'd gotten about your piece. And when you think about it, that is feedback from a relatively discerning audience. Yeah. You know, he's probably at a cocktail party with fellow journalists. And for that matter, people who write letters to the editor are probably unusually thoughtful. So that was where the feedback was coming from. All of a sudden, you're getting just the raw numbers on what, you know, the total number of readers, regardless of how carefully they read. And what Mike said to me was, I don't think I'm going to make this information available to writers. Mm-hmm. I think it would be bad for them if they actually started finding out which of their pieces get the most traffic.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, I think you have to say he was right. You know, if you look at what the average headline, you know, even at relatively highbrow publications reads, like in the way things are pitched to get our attention, I think that was a very sage thing to say, even if it was a hopeless cause in the long run.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, I think it's true. And it's like, you know, any of us who are paid to do work by publications that we respect are on some level respecting them for resisting the logic of their own business models. I mean, it's a strange situation, but yeah.
So do you think to some extent, I mean, we've said that your view is, what's making everyone crazy is a long way from just being Trump or just being Brexit. There's also like this whole new form of interaction between people and the news, where the news feels more pervasive and more immediate and more local.
Right.
And they, meanwhile, are reacting to it in conversation with people and so on. There's all of that. Do you think you could go further and say that that world helped? And maybe you say this in the piece, I'm not sure. I think you kind of do either say it or hint at it. But that world was partly responsible for bringing us Trump and Brexit?
Yeah, I mean, that seems almost self-evident to me. Maybe I didn't emphasize it because I don't know.
I think you did say it. You didn't make a big deal out of it. I mean,
I think it's definitely, I think, especially if you read like Tim Wu's book and look at the history of the attention economy, it becomes makes much more sense not to think of Trump as somebody who came along and cunningly exploited a situation that was arising, but is just produced by this system, right? The attention economy was just a giant machine for finding Donald Trump and electing him president. From that sort of perspective, it could have been anyone. And in the same way, to the extent that sort of social media and all sorts of suspicious activity on social media seems to have played a big role in the Brexit results. You know, I think it's just as easy to say it's not so much that a few sort of shadowy characters were manipulating social media. It's just that social media brought these kind of disputes to a point where they could be, you know, such a difference could be made by bad actors. So you sort of, you know, these are not contradictory points. The system is manipulated, and the system sort of brings these manipulators into being. But yeah, no, I think, I mean, yeah, it gets very difficult to sort of figure out how you prove one or the other. That's not something I would.
Well, there's also a thing. I mean, the anecdote you start the piece with, which is about, you know, there are some people enjoying themselves in some, I don't know, some bar, some pub or cafe or something, minding their own business. This is 2015, I think. Mm-hmm. And then a number of them have smartphones that I guess are amenable to news alerts, as some people do. And the smartphones start buzzing, and they all get drawn into a drama that's unfolding in Paris, which was the terrorist attack at the, I guess it's the Bataclan theater, where more than 100 people were killed. And one of your points is that the news, you know, news from around the world used to seem like news in this far off place, but more and more, I mean, it doesn't for various reasons. You have the video and more video and so on, but also it is kind of pushed in front of your face in various ways, these notifications being one of them. And the reason I bring that up in the context of the question of whether this world brought us Trump is, you know, the more people felt that those kinds of terrorist attacks were an affront to them personally and were threatening them personally, the better for Trump, right? That fear anywhere was your fear, or that a threat anywhere was your threat, is definitely like a pro-Trump perception, right?
Yeah, no, totally, right? Because you want the sort of appetite for a sort of populist leader like that, for authoritarianism, for all the rest of it, is directly related to feeling afraid, and the social networks operating through mobile technology sort of put the fear in your pocket all the time. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that.
Now, do you adjust your, you know, people, we talk about what's happening on Twitter as if Twitter is this one place and everyone's looking at the same stuff. But of course, we all get to define our feed to some extent, although Twitter is complicated by that by, you know, using an increasingly arcane algorithm to show us stuff we didn't particularly ask for. Still, by and large, you have a lot of control of what you're going to see. Have you tailored your own feed? I mean, what are the criteria for your creation of your own Twitter feed in light of your view on this?
I've put a lot of thought into, you know, to an obsessive degree about, like, how much I'm on the network and where and when. And I'd love to talk to you about that, because I feel like I want to get some tips from you, but much less into sort of the curation of the network, really. I mean, I have sort of very deliberately unfollowed some people, even though I found myself agreeing with them. You know, the usual unfollow is kind of when you're so outraged by somebody filling your feed with nonsense that you decide never to read their tweets again. But I have occasionally, you know, taking someone out of that mix, because I was just like, I can see what this is doing to me. You know, I can see that this is just making me angrier and angrier in a sort of righteous fashion. And I totally agree with this person, but that's not particularly healthy. I feel like I've gone in phases of kind of following lots of people, and then I don't feel like I've followed anyone new for ages. So I probably should be, thinking more carefully about that. The thing I really think about carefully is like, how do I not have it on in the background of my day? So, you know, I certainly don't have it on my phone.
You don't have a Twitter app on your phone?
Not on my phone. No.
Had one?
I stopped that pretty early. No, I think I have now and again had one on my phone. No, that's always been pretty easy for me. The much harder thing is like finding the latest app that will, you know, prevent me from accessing it on my laptop while I'm...
Oh, you use those, the self-discipline or the lack of self-discipline apps?
Yeah, totally. What I really want someone to invent is one that uses GPS so that I can only check Twitter at a designated place, so that I like have to go, you know, take my computer to the public library.
Right. Siberia or somewhere like.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I would love to, genuinely love to know. I mean, because I feel like, you know, I get a lot in your newsletter and elsewhere about sort of moment to moment mindfulness of tweeting. But does that extend for you to sort of rules about when you allow yourself to check it? Or I do sometimes think these rules are counterproductive because it makes it far more, you know, banning yourself from things is not always a great.
I mean, for me, it's the kind of discipline I impose has more to do with when I need to get a lot of work done and I just want to stay offline entirely. And it's true that Twitter would be one of the main attractions if I couldn't keep myself, offline. But I mean, what I do then is, I actually turn off, first I turn off the Wi-Fi.
Okay.
And then I put tape over that part of my computer so I can't even see the little airplane thing that replaced the Wi-Fi icon. Because if you don't, you will, without even thinking about it, right? Yeah. I mean, if it's physically possible to go online, you'll do it without even giving it any consideration, especially since these legitimate needs arise, or at least needs you want to convince yourself are legitimate. You know, you're writing something, you need to know some fact. The truth is it would be fine if you didn't find the fact until you finish the draft, but,
yeah,
you know, you've
been there. No, there's always good reasons. That's the whole problem. Yeah.
Yep. So suppose you could be this perfectly mindful person. And, you know, just could keep your emotions out of it and could reflect on every tweet and decide what the most judicious thing to do is, the thing that's best for society. I mean, then would it be okay? Like, if I attained enlightenment, would you let me spend a lot of time on Twitter?
It's so ridiculous for me to tell anyone else that they shouldn't be, fixated by social media for hours at a time. Yeah, whether you'd want to in that state seems to me that an interesting question. But yeah, I think that
right.
I think that it's totally possible to tweet mindfully and to be someone who is present on that platform with the role of maybe spreading that way of relating to things. Causing people to doubt the certainty of their own opinions a little bit, or to empathize in some meaning of that.
You mean word. People on your side in particular?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's quite, again, that's very, lots of people think they're doing that. And it's very easy to, you know, it's the main reason that I think people call each other out is to sort of feel better about themselves. But I don't think it's necessarily structured into the idea of, you know, that you couldn't be some kind of, useful, I don't know, gadfly, whatever the annoying.
Yeah, but it's hard to do it without getting shouted down in a way that's painful if you're a normal human being.
Yeah.
It's also hard to do without actually being a little bit of an obnoxious scold.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, and that it kind of connects to, well, maybe this is not quite a direct logical question, but it connects to something that I do think about, because I think that I probably agree with you a lot, and the general idea that a lot of the way people are relating to politics on Twitter is directly counterproductive. This thing about, you know, the sort of the opposition getting a lot of fuel from the idea that people like me, people like you are looking down on them, and that sort of way in which attempting to sort of humiliate the other side into silence never works, and that they all come, you know, get much more angry and active as a result. It's clear that that is a real dynamic. What I occasionally worry about when I'm trying to sort of, you know, deliberately devil's advocate my position, try to undermine my position, you know, figure out what I'm missing, is whether that effect it necessarily outweighs the other effect. In other words, of tribalism as something to sort of coordinate and motivate people. In other words, like, what if it is the case that regrettably the best way for the Democrats to win the 2020 election is to work the Democratic base up into a lather of fury get them to the polls and just overwhelm the side that they have made furious and hurt by their actions. And I hope that politics doesn't work like that, but if it does,
I'm afraid I'd have to go with that. I mean, given my own, you know, ideology and everything, I consider this something approaching a national emergency. And I really don't think that's just a matter of ideology. You know, right. I think if you had 6 years ago just taken a poll of people and said, would you want a president, regardless of your ideology, do you want a president who, when he visits London, makes fun of the mayor for being short, right? Literally, for being a man of short physical stature, do you want that in a president? I think there's all kinds of things you could list about Trump where everybody would have said in the abstract, wow, that'll be a step down if we have a president who does that stuff.
Yeah.
Now, I understand how, you know, if you feel strongly about issues and feel strongly you're not being heard and the other side holds you in contempt and so on, then you're willing to settle for imperfection in your leader. We all do that. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's a sign of stupidity that Trump supporters accept him as he is. I'm just trying to make the case that you could imagine a representative of his ideology, to the extent that you can attribute a coherent ideology to him, who was less bad for America, right? That would be better, but that's not what we have. He's not that.
In a lot of the kind of coverage from the left and the liberal position, when I have problems with that approaches that come from there, it's usually because of this sense that the response to Trumpism as a phenomenon is that you just have to outdo these people at the polls. You have to sort of jettison 30% of the American population as not allowed to have a role in politics, and we have to wait for time to pass and for generations to die, and eventually those people won't be a problem anymore. And I think that's probably a very bad way of thinking about politics, that you have to try to understand the deep, deep roots of people's emotional grievances, even if the ways in which they manifest them are really abhorrent and immoral. And I think connects to lots of Buddhist ideas, right, about evil not really being a thing and being sort of very mistaken rather than deeply malevolent at the most basic level. And so I never like it when I read that kind of stuff, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't the best tactic for.
Right. I mean, I should say, you know, I do think there's a danger that a short-term victory that's won in that fashion in the end does a lot of damage, in which case I wouldn't be so enthusiastic about the tactics. And in my ideal world, you wouldn't have to use those tactics at all. I just happen to think that 4 more years of Trump, I mean, could leave the world in a very bad place. And so I guess I would be willing to resort to the use of cheap emotional devices and things like that if absolutely forced. But, okay, so do you have any parting advice? The one point you made when you said, when I said, have you attained enlightenment, and you said, and you kind of said something about, well, I'm not sure you'd bother, you know, at that point, want to be engaged. That is kind of a line that's fine line that's difficult to stay on, right? Where you're, you have the motivation to engage and you've abandoned pretty much all of the emotional reactivity that makes you a counterproductive engager, right? In other words, you drop all the stuff that enables you to engage productively, and you're almost to the point where you're like, hey, why bother, right? I mean, that's the danger you're alluding to.
Well, yeah, I guess that I don't know that it's a danger in the context of Twitter, because I'm genuinely not sure that it would be a worse world if everyone decided not to use Twitter ever again. But there's definitely that sort of broader problem that comes up when you sort of get involved in Buddhism, right? Which is, you kind of think, well, if I actually pursued this all the way to the end, why would I might not have the motivation to do anything. I think one of the ways you write about that is to say, like, okay, well, look, even if this is a theoretical problem,
right,
if you're not there, if you're nowhere near there at this stage.
Let me know when that actually happens.
I also think that, you know, something that changes and has changed for me to the extent that I've got saner towards social media is, you know, it's not enjoyable even there's no sense of doing something meaningful when you engage with most political argument in the social media context. But when you do things, either political things or other sort of worthwhile community things on a more local and concrete level and with real people, like, you know, it's fun on some level. It feels like you did something good with your day. So there's a kind of an alignment between just wanting a nice life and doing something good in those kinds of context, because it does feel meaningful. So I kind of, you know, this is older, this is not, I'm like the 8,000th person to say, like, go local, but I feel like that is a big part of why that is true. It's because, you know, local is this kind of engagement with the real world around you and people. And it's,
now you're talking about actual physical engagement as distinguished from online engagement, or you're talking about local kinds of causes as opposed to more global causes? Or
I imagine that both are true. I was actually thinking more about, like, walking out of the house. You know, I think probably one of the difficult things is the sense that, you know, things are so bad, either politically at a national, international level, or above all, you know, environmentally, which we haven't even really talked about, that for me to go and volunteer for an hour at my local community garden is just utterly, utterly pointless. For me to go and, you know, visit an elderly housebound person for an hour every week is kind of a completely beside the point. And I feel like we need some kind of ethic of being sort of active in the world that doesn't lead to that conclusion, because there's something wrong with a way of thinking about what we need to do that sort of says the only level of action that matters is one at which you don't feel like you can have any meaningful effect. But I haven't thought this through, so I'm.
Well, I mean, I think we, you know, as a rule, you kind of, you know, if you abandon the idea that having good incremental effects, good marginal effects is worth trying to do, then you're probably going to have trouble convincing yourself that life has meaning, right? I mean, it's the same on, I mean, what, one thing you say in the piece is, like, when you're online, when you're on Twitter, maybe you should abandon this idea that, however small a positive difference you're making, you can make one, you can do it. And you're saying maybe you should just give that up. Get off of Twitter. If I'm paraphrasing you to the point of misrepresentation, let me know. But I think you said something like that. And I kind of thought, well, yeah, but don't we, I mean, doesn't considering life meaningful and continuing to strive on generally in the sense of just waking up and doing stuff depend for most people who, like, aren't president and stuff, depend on the idea that having relatively small but beneficial effects on the world is worth pursuing?
100%, yes. I just don't, I question how much that is actually real on Twitter, because I feel like this is a designed environment to make it feel like very small effects that really just send data back to headquarters and make sure your stream is more compelling than before feel like small efficacious action. I'm all about small efficacious action, and if you could convince me that my tweeting could do that, I think that would be as legitimate as anything else. I just feel like it's very difficult to see how that works, because, you know, somebody was saying, I was reading a blog post the other day that made this point that, like, you know, even if you go on Twitter and criticize the way that Jack Dorsey runs Twitter and tweet at him and do your best to try and make it a healthier place, all that does is, this person was saying, you know, tell Twitter's algorithms that your community of interest is people who criticize Jack Dorsey, so you see more tweets from other people, and, you know, the system is fine with that, even if
yes, Jack has not yet responded to my guidance.
Say again?
Jack has not responded to the guidance I've offered him. online.
He did a lot of meditating though.
What? He did do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something. And he caught hell for that, of course, because the way he presented. Well, okay. So anyway, you're a tend your garden guy, right? That's your,
I think that's the point that this all leads to. I hope in the piece and also in this conversation, I have not given anyone the impression that I have found my enlightened peace with Twitter, because then you'll put this conversation out and I'll be in the middle of a meltdown.
Of a Twitter firestorm. I hope we're both so lucky that this becomes the subject of a Twitter firestorm.
No, I just mean I'll be in the middle of one anyway, you know, that day. Anyone happens to check my feed, they'll see that I've completely failed to abide by all these things. I think I'm getting better at it in a halting fashion.
You mean better at withstanding the...
Better at the message of mindful resistance, yeah.
Oh, good. Maybe I should be getting guidance from you.
No. I mean, those newsletters are a great help. I think that way of responding on social media is absolutely the way to do it. If you respond at all, the question in my mind is maybe I just shouldn't be on the platform to begin with.
Well, I don't know. I personally think of you as a pretty benign influence, benign in the more positive sense. You know, benign has come to mean to some people just not harmful, but I think it also has the connotation of actually kind of healthful. That's my take on you. I don't ever see you tweet and think, oh, that's doing damage. I don't.
I'm flattered to hear it. That's an endorsement. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, thank you for taking the time to encourage everyone to if not tend their garden, tend their community garden, I guess, or something. Metaphorically tend your community garden. Is that fair?
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Metaphorically. Okay. And thanks. And as long as we're talking to Twitter, where can we find you on Twitter? What is your Twitter handle?
I'm Oliver Berkman, Burkeman on Twitter. Yeah.
Okay. And I'm Robert Ryder, Righter. And so thanks. Are you, you're not going to write a book, I assume, until your toddler grows up, or are you going to write another book?
I'm trying to write one at the moment.
But are you, can you, are you, are you the kind of person who doesn't talk about what the books, the works in progress are about?
No, it's difficult. I find the elevator pitch hard, but not because I'm not out of wanting to be coy. It's that I'm trying to look at sort of time management in a general way, bringing to bear various sort of older philosophical ideas from some ideas from Buddhism, some ideas from
Stoicism.
Although Stoicism a little bit. Heidegger I'm trying to make work at the moment, which is a complete nightmare. But just trying to sort of go beyond the kind of make yourself more and more efficient until you can get on top of everything ethic of sort of productivity books as standard, which just seem to have the effect of making you feel busier and emptier. So
it's a self-help book.
From a perspective of, you know, human mortality.
So it's a non-self-help book.
Yeah, that seems to be what I do.
Okay, and your publisher will insist on getting rid of the first part of that, I suspect, when it comes time to decide how to market it. But but thank you for taking the time, Oliver. We'll link to the piece. Great piece. Everyone should read it and should read your column. This column will change your life, because it will change your life.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.